Hey, this is Steve from Dinner and a Podcast, and you're listening to the Nerd Podcast Mafia, entertainment your ears can't refuse.
Welcome to the continued podcast adventures of Superhero Speak.
But I think many of the people that love this character and that love superheroes in general have used these stories as inspiration to say, you know what, I'm going to do something good in the world. I'm going to make a difference like my hero when I was a kid.
That is my fondest memory of it, because when you're doing comic books, you want them to affect people,
right?
You want people to care. You want to strike emotions. And I knew that Clone Saga was striking a lot of emotions.
Can you imagine Pulp Fiction starring Goofy and Mickey Mouse?
I can totally imagine that.
I'm sure somebody's written that one too.
Quarter pounder with cheese in France, Mickey? What? Boy, ale with cheese, Mickey. Yeah. I can totally
see.
I would watch the hell out of that movie.
Yes, I gladly sacrifice up my progeny to you, a mighty Marvel beast.
But Neil Adams is somewhere going, it's my time.
How do you measure success?
Hey, everyone. You're listening to Superhero Speak, and I'm your host, Dave.
And John.
And JD's off again this week, boys and girls. He's busy teaching young men how to roll around on the floor together. That came out wrong.
He's going to get you for that.
He has to do his wrestling camp this summer, so he's busy coaching there. So we had to bring in some big guns to help us review this movie this week. And, of course, he's a returning guest on the show. He's one of the creative minds behind the Terminal Project. And, of course, it's the one and only Steve Ekstrom. How are you doing, sir?
I'm great. Thanks. Big guns. That's very appropriate for what I did at the gym today. Thank you.
Cool. So, before we, dive into it, it's been a little while since you were on the show. And, of course, I think the Project Terminal was a great idea. I love it. What's going on with that? And like, what can you tell the listeners of anything that might be coming up for it?
Well, we have a lot of stuff going on. We're going to be launching a second Kickstarter. I hope to be fulfilling the rewards here in the next week or two. I'm waiting on a couple of odds and ends to come in the mail so that I can mail large packages out. And some prints, or I'm waiting on basically print art that can turn around and be stuffed in an envelope. Mm-hmm. And then, we have about 200 orders to fulfill. I have all the shirts, everything else is ready to rock, and it's just kind of sitting here. I'm just kind of waiting for certain things to arrive, and the anticipation is kind of driving me crazy. But we're also, I don't want to start another Kickstarter without people's things being in the mail from the first one. So we're hoping to, by middle of next month, to be starting a new Kickstarter for 3 and 4. And it's going to feature Justin Gray from DC Comics, Jonah Hex, Hawkman. He was partnered up with Jamie Palmiotti for a number of years. It's also going to feature Eric Palicki from Black Mask, his book No Angel, with his sister Adrian Palicki. Also, it's going to feature a second book that, if we overfund, the second book is free to our backers. So number 4 is going to have Purple Hearts, Vito Del Santi, with my close friend Antonio Brando from Portugal, as well as Matt Brady, who used to be the ubermind behind Newsarama. He's going to publish a story with a newcomer from Croatia that I don't want to butcher his name, but his name is Nikola Cizmejica. And he's super talented. And, I was just lucky enough to kind of stumble across this guy on Instagram. And we've got a number of other guests that are going to be joining this next book for, like, the variants and for, like, trade dress art, like John Rausch, Richard Pace, as well as Rafa Gares and Josh Adams, Jeff Johnson from Wonder Man, which is like a dream come true for me because he's one of my favorites from when I was a kid. And Eisner winner Vasilis Lolas is going to be providing some art for us as well. So we've kind of got a stacked deck this next time. And it's going to be just in time for the launch of our website, which is going to feature webcomics from Troy Brownfield, Justin Peniston William Orr, Nkaru Otherworlds, and Marco Lopez. And we're basically launching imminent.online is going to be our website. And we're going to publish regular web content. And it's also going to be kind of a place where we all organize under our digital brand as like a digital studio. So there'll be articles about different members of the studio. There will be news about press releases about projects. Because we're all going to self-publish underneath the Imminent brand on this website. And we'll also put information about shows we'll be attending and things like that. And we want to kind of solidify our audience in the hopes that a rising tide will raise all ships and kind of put us all on the map together. And we're kind of, our organization is kind of coming together and we're bringing the comics.
Cool. Oh, cool. I mean, you had me up until you mentioned that hack, Troy Brownfield. You know,
oh, yeah. he's kind of the wind beneath my wings. If we were beaches together, if it weren't for Troy, I would probably be trying to figure out how to do this on my own. And his friendship and just being partners with him for so many years, he discovered me for Newsarama. With Best Shots, and it turned into, you know, a gig where I was getting paid to be a journalist, and it was amazing. And I owe a lot to him and Matt Brady both. And so it's always a pleasure to be able to do things with them so that we can include people that we know are hungry to want to make comics, and they want to be more than just some guy that languishes that would like to be a comic book creator. But we really want to do this. Like, this is like everybody that's involved with our group loves the genre, loves the medium. And, you know, we hope that by organizing, people will start to see how serious we are about this.
Cool. Yeah, no, obviously I kid. For those who are regular listeners, they know Troy's been on the show many times. He's a good friend of the show. And in fact, if you listen to the intro, there is a clip where we are talking about what if Mickey and Goofy were the stars of Pulp Fiction, and he is the one doing the Minnie and Goofy impersonations, and it's one of my all-time favorite episodes. So if you haven't listened to it, it was the second time Troy was on the show. You should go back and listen to it. So cool. So you've been up to a lot. John, what have you been up to since last week?
Well, watched a movie. That's basically it.
Oh, okay.
Oh, and following Gal Gadot as she works her way through through the hospitals, dressed up in full Wonder Woman regalia, going to the terminally ill kids. So I'm really impressed with that.
Yes, yes. She's copying what they do over at the Marvel Studios. Oh, sorry. Was that out loud?
It's really rad. I got to say that it was on the news while I was at the gym, and you can't just help but go, aw, when you see that, because it's like these people step up and they go above and beyond their job of paying, you know, being paid to play a character. And it's kind of neat that they become this ethical quality of this character. You know, like Pratt and Evans are, you know, basically Star-Lord and Captain America, but you also have Wonder Woman, you know, doing things. I mean, Christian Bale doesn't talk with an accent when he was Bruce Wayne. You know, he speaks like Bruce Wayne the entire time he was filming those movies. Right. So that's kind of cool. But when you take it a step forward and you start doing charitable things for children, it really lets you know that these people believe in what they're doing.
Oh yeah, no, definitely, and it's a great thing, you know, and it's such a simple thing, but it really brings joy to these kids, you know, and you know, people do joke and or not joke, people are cynical, people are like, oh, they're just looking for free publicity, and it's like, well, even if they are, they're still bringing joy to the kids, so let them be happy, you know.
They don't have to do that. They really don't have to do that. I mean, okay, they get some good press out of it. But I mean, if you follow Gal Gadot at all, you know that she did this because she wanted to, because it was the right thing to do. And because you look at the pictures of all the kids, you know, they did group photos, and you know, that's the reason she did it, not for the press or anything.
Yeah. Oh, cool. Yeah, what have I been up to? Not much either.
Well, you've got grandkids now, so.
Exactly. That takes up most of my time. Cool. So we're going to get into it, but there is something I wanted to make sure we mentioned on the show. Unfortunately, since the last time we've all gotten together, the one and only Steve Ditko has passed away at age 90. And co-creator of Spider-Man and Doctor Strange, not to mention countless other characters. And
Speedball.
Say that again?
Speedball.
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, he, you know, obviously these are characters everyone who knows, who listens to the show and everyone that knows me, I'm a huge Marvel fan. And of course, Spider-Man is my number one. I've always been a huge Doctor Strange fan as well. So it just means so much to me, these characters. It's, you know, it was the escapism when I was a kid. It's, what made me feel good when, you know, you get picked on and all that kind of stuff. And, probably wouldn't have made it through my childhood without these characters. And, he will be missed. Would you guys have any memories of Steve Ditko you'd like to share or anything you want to say?
I mean, Spider-Man is a cornerstone of the modern industry. And, to have somebody like that, you know, it's just like Kirby. How much did Jack Kirby create? How much did Steve Ditko create? One thing that I said when I found out he passed was, man, this guy, the only thing that surpassed this guy's talent was this dude's will to persist in his own way and to control his own destiny as an artist. And he was a bit of a recluse. And, you know, he stayed away from a lot of mainstream comics for a long time. But you can't help but see his influence. Like, we were looking at one of the stories that's going to be in Terminal Number 3, and we were talking about, man, the Ditko influence and Doctor Strange love that is in, not Doctor Strange love, but the love for Doctor Strange in this story. It's basically like Big Lebowski meets Doctor Strange by way of Jeff Goldblum. And it's just this, you know, you feel it when you're looking, and they're like, man, it's so coincidental that this kind of came out when this was happening, because the story was written 2 years ago and we were talking about, you know, Ditko and stuff. And I just, there's so much that this guy has enriched my life. You know, I can't, how do you thank somebody for that? And so when somebody like that passes away, it's a huge, just like gut punch. Mm-hmm. As somebody who loves these things, you know, loves these damn pamphlets. And, I never got to meet him. I always enjoyed all these misanthropic stories of him kind of being this outlier. And I was like, man, that's kind of cool. And it reminds me also of my friend Rob G, who worked with Brian Wood and stuff, and he did some artwork for us. I went to high school with Rob, and Rob's a bit of an outlier. So I like Facebook messaged him the other night, and I said, you know, you have to do a Ditko tribute piece of homage art, you know, and because you're just like Steve Ditko. And he just kind of ... didn't respond. So I'm hoping that he's going to do something really cool that pays homage to Ditko.
Yeah. How about you, John? Any favorite Spider-Man memories?
No, but Squirrel Girl.
Oh, yeah.
Squirrel Girl.
Yeah. I am so broken. The creator of Squirrel Girl is gone. I mean, Spider-Man, yeah, of course. I mean, Spider-Man. But Squirrel Girl. I mean, somebody who really, really did clean up a lot of the chaff of the Marvel Universe.
Yes. The most powerful of the Avengers.
I just, it feels, I mean, okay, like we joke about me being old and everything, but you get to a certain point in your life and you start seeing, like, it in my field, you're seeing a lot of the people that helped create all of the infrastructure of the internet and PCs as we know them today and all that. and it feels like a change of the guard, and it's what it feels like with the with comics, because you're seeing all these original people who have made characters that are going to well outlast them by you know, we're talking centuries. I mean, I can't see a way that like Superman or Spider-Man or some of these characters will ever really go away. And it's amazing the impact that they've had on people's lives, the impact they've had on the arts, on writing. And, you know, it's, we're going to need, they're leaving some very big shoes to fill.
Yeah. I agree with that. It's what did Grant Morrison call superheroes? The man's modern mythology.
Yeah.
We have this awesome pantheon of characters that exist for us now in so many different ways now because of transmedia.
Yeah. Except in this mythology, we don't have to fear the gods. Well, except for,
Thanos.
Except for the Joker, if he's played by Leto. So, yeah.
Oh, fair enough. Fair enough.
Oh, that's not nice. Yeah, no, and I'm not trying to besmirch anything or start any kind of craziness. It's just, it's also, of course, like you alluded to, Steve, he was a recluse for a long time. He continued to work. He just never was in the public eye. He didn't like to do interviews. And all we know about him and Stan Lee is that they had a falling out at some point. He left Marvel, and neither one of them will, like, talk about what happened. And I guess, you know, we'll probably never find out the answer now, right? It's a shame, you know. It's a shame to think that they never reconciled, you know. They both lived... They both have lived a really long time and they never reconciled. So,
yeah, let that be a lesson to you if you're listening to this, you know, never let anything go like that.
Yeah.
Absolutely. 100%.
All right. So now let's get on to the main event of the evening.
Let's bring it up a notch.
Yes. Yes. We're here to, of course, talk about Marvel's Ant-Man and the Wasp, released this past weekend in the movie theater. And
I did it again. I thought it was Wasp Woman. The 1950s flick. I mean, you know.
But you wouldn't have. You told me you went to the theater. You wouldn't go to the theater to see that, would you?
Well, it depends on the theater. If you're on enough cold medication.
Oh, you can see anything. I know. All right. Let's start out like we normally do. We'll go around the room. Everyone give your initial non-spoiler reaction before we get into, you know, details and spoilers. So we'll start with our guest host.
I thought it was fantastic. In fact, I thought it surpassed the first one, which was in my top five. And I think Ant-Man and the Wasp bumped Ant-Man out of my top five to become number five. I really enjoy Paul Rudd. I think that these movies are structured the right way so that it's just kind of big, dumb fun with a nice sci-fi kick to it. I didn't think I was going to like the choice of Michael Douglas as Hank Pym, but he's kind of perfect too in a volatile scientist kind of way. And Evangeline Lilly is, my woman crush Wednesday every day. So that's kind of, I really was there for her more than anything, because I think her character's rad and she's gorgeous and fun to watch on film. So that movie was great.
Cool. All right. How about you, John?
Well, I was really surprised when they faced off against Thanos. I didn't expect that this early.
Spoiler alert.
Wait,
that was in the trailers, wasn't it?
And they won.
Yeah. And then, you know, when they went through the quantum foam and they saw, you know, quantum Dr. Manhattan, foam. that was really something too. All joking aside. This was a fun ride. And I've heard it described as a palate cleanser for after Infinity War. And I think that's very apropos. I think it's just a fun movie to go see. It's not like an epic battle type movie. It's not real heavy. A few of the jokes didn't land, but otherwise there are some really funny moments in this, and it's well worth your time.
Especially when you get to meet the greatest grandma in the world.
Oh God.
You know, the deadpan delivery from, what is his daughter's name?
Cassie.
Cassie, yeah, Abby Ryder Fortson.
Oh, she's one to watch for.
She's fantastic. And just the fact that she had this she's amazing chemistry with Rudd on film. And it was just really good. My daughter's 12, and I remember when she was like 10 and cute like that, and everything was nice and heartwarming. And now my kid's kind of a smelly jerk. But sorry, Katie, I know you'll never listen to this, but maybe one day if you dig it up. It just reminded me of my kid, and I was just kind of just smiling really big the whole time, you know? So it was nice. That chemistry is nice.
Yeah, I totally understand about the when they get older, because, I mean, mine are 24 and 16 now, so I remember when they were 10 and cute. I honestly, yeah, I really enjoyed it too. I mean, especially not just after Infinity War, but, you know, Black Panther, you're dealing with fighting for a kingdom and control of a huge resource, and even Ragnarok is the destruction of Asgard, and like these big heavy duty Marvel movies. And this was, you know, I mean, yeah, there's some significant stuff in it, but it still was more just of a fun movie. You know, it reminded me of those like tie-in issues of a big crossover event that really doesn't deal with the crossover event. There's like one little thing that ties it in, and the rest is just a good fun story. So yeah, I really enjoyed it. It was a good, fun summer movie, and I back up what you guys said. Everyone who hasn't seen it yet needs to run out now and go see the movie.
Yeah, grab some. This is definitely a popcorn movie. Just go there with a bunch of friends and have some fun.
Cool.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. I'm probably going to go see it a second time later this week when I need a break from staring at computer screen lettering all night.
Cool. So, before we get into the spoilers, like we normally do here, we like to look at the numbers. What are the reactions? How did it do in the box office? We can start off with box office numbers. It made $75.8 million domestically and $161 million worldwide. So
it broke a record, didn't it? I heard it broke a record.
July 4th opening?
So biggest July 4th opening.
Most people don't go to the movies on that weekend, you know? You have to think that's an easy record to break, but not to diminish the movie because it's fantastic. But Marvel's been strategically putting these movies up on days where they're record-breaking because they're not – it's like they're it's low-hanging fruit. It's smart marketing.
Yeah. If we look at Rotten Tomatoes, the audience score is 79%, and the – Tomato meter has it at 86, so
pretty good.
A good solid B, and I definitely would agree with that. And then, of course, there's our audience on the Twitterverse. I did a little poll like I normally do for these movies, and of course the question is, what did you think of Marvel's Ant-Man and the Wasp? Let us know. And I gave four possible answers. The first answer was better than Infinity War. The second possible answer is giant fun, small package. The third answer is a ghost of the first one. Haha, see what I did there?
No, I do not. I refuse to.
Right over my head.
And the bottom answer is ants are gross. So, the number one answer was, giant fun small package at 65%. The next highest answer was answer gross at 12%.
Of course.
16% said Ghost of the First One, and only 7% said that it was better than Infinity War, which I would imagine not a lot of people are going to feel that way.
Yeah. These are highly scientific polls.
Yes, yes, yes. We do the best research here when we create our polls.
We use all the stats.
Mikey Wallen Jr. said that he really liked it. Funny as hell. We need a story where the universe isn't on the line every now and then. And the podcast One Giant Leap for Geeks said, thought the first was meh, liked the second, but still recognize it's a mid-tier movie. Wow. Okay, so...
Not everything's going to be The Godfather.
Exactly. Yeah, I totally agree with that.
Not everything's going to be The Godfather 2. And I think, like, I would love to go off on a tangent about fan expectations, because it's really unfortunate what's going on with various franchises right now and the fan entitlement that's happening with it. If you really don't like stuff, don't go spend money on it. And go get a film degree and make a movie that's better.
And they're spoiled these days. I mean, you know, yes. If you flash back to, like, you know, 12 years ago, when there was, like, nothing on,
nothing no superhero movies? The theater.
Yeah. Okay, fine. If you go, just remember that, because, you know, this will end at some point, and then you'll be back to, man, you know, wish somebody would make a superhero movie. I mean, after DC kills the genre. But.
What I hope happens is I hope somebody at Warner says, we need to just start from scratch. Marvel's got an advance on us, and they just need to focus on making good movies. It's the same thing as making good comics. Focus on making good comics and then wait for it to turn into something else later. Focus on a good movie or two and then wait for it to turn into something. Marvel planned this out. You can't drop Justice League in a half-baked way with half-baked stuff and expect it to do gangbusters. There were how many movies before Avengers showed up? Like 5? Hmm.
And look at this. This is Ant-Man and the Wasp.
Right.
Right? I mean, this is number 2 in this part of the franchise. You know that the planning had to be good, the execution had to be good to get to the point where we have an Ant-Man and Wasp number 2 that's still breaking records, and it's not even an epic story. It's just a fun romp. It's basically a science fiction romp is what it is.
Oh, yeah.
And it just, I don't know. Anyway,
I agree with you.
Actually, real quick, I just refreshed our Twitter page, and I just want to make sure I include these guys too, Stranger Lands Podcast. They said, I liked it a lot. I enjoyed it. It was a smaller scale movie, no pun intended, in scope of world and instead of world ending disasters. So, that's exactly how I feel. Like I said, it was a fun, smaller scale movie. It was well done, well acted. And here we go. This is where we're going to get into detail, boys and girls.
Good. So
this is your spoiler warning.
There was one disaster. Poor Antonio Banderas.
Oh, my gosh. I actually really dig that is like a thing that's occurring, where he's naming these creatures, you know, and it's, you're like, oh, that's great, you know. He really, you see that Scott Lang cares about what he's doing. I like that he's kind of the ne'er-do-well dude who means well, but he kind of puts his foot in it a lot. And that was one of the best things to me, was when the seagulls were plucking all the ants out of the sky. And I was just like, oh, this is just brutal. And I was like trying to imagine what like a 7-year-old would think sitting there watching this, just mortified that these bugs were getting eaten.
Yeah.
Well, if you're a 7-year-old, you'd be the one grabbing the ants and throwing them in the air.
That's true. You don't want to know what I used to do with ant beds. It's horrible.
Oh, that's not nice.
Yeah, I used to have a magnifying glass. I know.
And that's snails and salt, all that stuff.
Yeah, but you grow up and you realize that they're, you know, like Antonio Banderas.
Yes, yeah. I really, there was a lot of really cool, like, just fun sci-fi in this movie with the Hot Wheel container with all the cars.
Oh, that was brilliant.
The building with the handle on it, like a piece of, you know, luggage was cute.
Okay.
I liked all of that stuff. And then the hard sci-fi with the, just the just different physics things that were going on with, what was the big thing with the energy and, with the ghost?
The dimensional sharding or whatever she was going through. She was quantumly unstable.
Yes.
So she needed to be stabilized.
That was kind of neat, man. And that was a good take on that. I didn't think I was going to like the take on the character because I like the ghost character from Iron Man. And I was like, holy crap, this is actually a really good idea. This weaponized accident. And I just was super into, and that girl was very interesting. I've never seen her in any movies before. Hannah John Kamen. I'm not sure how to pronounce that, but
that's
like
okay.
she's really like she's very. It's hard not to notice her.
Yeah, well,
she's got a very alluring magnetic quality.
Yeah, and interesting. Marvel has learned how to do villaining really well now, because you know you could have thrown a vanilla, you know, villain at this show and had the protagonist played off him. But in this case, they came up with another not a villain, an antagonist.
Right.
Ava. And she's not bad. She's just dealing with the fact that she's going to die if she doesn't do something.
Right. And she's kind of been trained to become this person that sees absolutes. You know,
by S.H.I.E.L.D.,
she's a weapon. And I really like the gray area villainy of the modern Marvel cinema. It's a great statement about postmodern villainy. And like how you have these people who are just in their actions. Killmonger, for Pete's sake, he's the best Marvel villain they've had. Thanos was. That take on Thanos was so much better than having him kiss a female skeleton of death. You know?
Yeah.
And this girl was just, it was kind of riveting to watch her kind of struggle. And I loved that Bill Foster was a part of this movie. Like, I was excited. And what was weird is I knew Lawrence Fishburne was in the movie, and I had somehow forgotten he was playing Bill Foster. So I, like, posted something on Facebook, and they were like, dude, you announced that he was going to be in the movie a year ago. I was like, I totally forgot, you know, and I was just super excited because it's one of those random characters from like, remember when Bill Foster showed back up in like a West Coast Avengers annual in the 90s? I didn't know who that Black Goliath was, and I thought it was just awesome, you know, because he had this terrible costume from the 70s that he was still wearing, that he kind of looked like Black Lightning in a way. And, it was just cool, you know, to have these touch points for comic book fans. And it's smart that they keep doing that. You know, they keep putting these things together. And I like the alluding to Cassie being stature and, you know, one day I want to be like my dad, because I have a feeling from what I've heard. Now, this is speculation because I've seen it on the internet. That doesn't mean it's true, that they've cast somebody older to play Cassie in a superhero role in the next Avengers movie. Because time travel's involved.
Yeah. And don't forget the other, like I said, antagonist, Sonny Birch, who is this kind of...
Walter Hawkins.
Yeah, Walter, who they give him pieces of scenery to chew on, and he does a really good, you know, mafia boss type guy. And it's fun to watch because you go through the whole movie, and he's always like one step behind everybody, and he's always like getting thwarted by the fact that he's dealing with these superpowered people, and it's just fun, you know.
What?
And I've read some reviews where they say that these villains are, you know, quote unquote forgettable or whatever, and you know, again, this is a palate cleanser. This is just good fun.
You have to remember that most of the people reviewing these movies don't read any comic books. Sonny Birch has already been introduced in Marvel books. He's you know, he worked for Obadiah Stane. I think it's cool when you have these little secondary characters that show up, and you know, your average moviegoer is not going to know who they are, but your bread and butter audience is going to be like, I know who that is.
Right.
You know, you want to know who this guy is. And Walter Coggins is hilarious.
Yes.
I enjoy everything he's in.
But but that's not the point. The point is that they're fun. They're part of the movie in a way that, you know, that drives the movie forward and keeps it light at the same time.
Well, I think that's one of the brilliances of how this movie was written villain-wise is, you know, Sonny is your mustache-twirling arms dealer who is the forgettable villain. You know, like, if he never comes back in a movie, you're not going to care. Where they made Ghost the interesting character, the person who can actually fight Ant-Man and the Wasp on their level.
The one you feel for.
And then the one you feel for, and they're able to write her in a way where she's sympathetic, so you want to see her again. You want to see a continuing story with her.
Absolutely. And what, you know, the other really interesting thing is they had Jimmy Woo, who was also this, like, other conflict. He's actually one of the good guys that's just doing his job, but he's a source of conflict for the characters because he's constantly checking up on Scott. And you also have this really fantastic character dynamic between Paul Rudd, Evangeline Lilly, and why am I blanking here? Douglas.
Douglas.
They're at odds with one another in how they're going to go about what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And so you have this great internal dynamic amongst them. There's a lot of interesting minor conflicts that make a series just a lot of conflict in this movie. And what was weird is that his ex-wife and his kid's stepfather are like super lovey and huggy this time, and they're not part of the conflict like they were in the first movie.
Yeah, no, and I think they had to, because I think if they made them, you know, part of the conflict this time around, people would have been like, it would have been too much, in my opinion. And they did resolve their relationship at the end of the first one, so why would all of a sudden they be mean to him again?
Right. There would be no growth.
Right, right.
I just thought it was kind of cute how they made them these, like, big fans of Lang now. And it was, like, good, you know? Like, he's got people that care about him.
Right.
And it's not this standard ex-wife routine, you know? Oh, and baby, you know, this is baby daddy conflict with cop, you know, stepdad kind of thing. They eliminated this kind of cliche and made it, they turned it on its ear. I also really thought that the dynamic with T.I. and David Dasmalchian as Kirk and Michael Pena as Luis, I think that that's a fantastic kind of element that just distracts you from the fact that this is kind of a simple movie. So you have these kind of like dancing clowns in certain parts that kind of just elevate the fun of the movie. There was a lot of things that were just barely carrying fun on its own. But when you mix it all together, it's just this long ride, this like roller coaster ride of just big fun.
That's an apt analogy. It's if you had a cook come to your kitchen and put together everything in such a way that it made it better than the whole.
Right.
And like I said at the beginning, there were like maybe three jokes that kind of landed flat for me because there were those kinds of things where they take something and they run it a little bit too long.
Sure.
They try to play on too long, but the rest of it was hysterical. The play on the tooth serum, what Luis does when he's on the quote unquote tooth serum, and just and the cameo. Oh, the cameo for
Stanley.
Stanley, yes.
Oh, yeah, that was a good cameo. There were some that are hit and miss. This one was great.
Oh, that was the best. And we're in spoiler territory. So, I mean, he sits there and he's trying to put his key into his car, and the car gets hit by a shrinking thing, and he's looking at it going, well, the 60s were fun, but I'm paying for it now.
Right, right. The fact that that was just a good joke. Like, that was just a solid joke from an old man, you know? And I cackled. Like, I know that I cackled out loud. So,
well, you know, the best humor is the humor that has a speck of truth in it. So, you got to guess, you know, he came from the 60s and he wrote comics and he created all these weird characters. You got to think he did a few things.
I kind of loved the name of the security firm that they all started. X-Con.
That was
smart. That was cute. Yeah.
Do we want to go into the CGI people? Because
the CGI. Okay. Oh, you mean the de-aging?
Yes. De-aging. Okay. It was seamless this time. Like, you could tell in the first one that Douglas was being whammed with technology. This one was really good. Like, I was kind of impressed with the way Lawrence Fishburne looked, and I was kind of marveling at it. And they did a really good job with Michelle Pfeiffer too, where I was like staring at the screen trying to find blurry scenes. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And from what I understand, Samuel L. Jackson is DH'd the entire Captain Marvel movie. So that's going to be a feat.
I never got a hint of Uncanny Valley in this one. And let's face it, okay, Michelle Pfeiffer is 60, and yet I doubt they had to use much CGI on her.
Yeah, she looks pretty gorgeous.
She looks amazing for 60. Are you kidding me? She looks like she's in her 40s at least. At most, excuse me. Sorry, Michelle, you're welcome on the show anytime. Yeah, and for Lawrence Fishburne, they just, you know, they just colored his hair and gave him a wig. That's basically that. That's all you need for him. It was really good. I mean, Michael Douglas was in the shadows for most of his scenes when they were doing flashbacks. But like I said, there was no hint. If I had known, I mean, it took me a second to realize, oh, yeah, he looked young. Oh, they aged them. Okay. You know, it wasn't like you said in the first Michael Douglas or Leia from
The Leia CGI isn't great, and a lot of people didn't like Tarkin, but I absolutely loved that Grand Moff Tarkin existed in Rogue One, and Peter Cushing lived again. The Carrie Fisher CGI wasn't all that great; it was shiny looking in a way. But
well, that was just the force. She was sparkling, you know.
Maybe, yeah, she's radiant with the force. I'm like radiant with rebellion. This was kind of remarkable, and I've already seen some stills of Samuel L. Jackson in Captain Marvel as Nick Fury with both eyes, and it's pretty fascinating that they're starting to do this, and it makes you wonder what we're going to see in the future. Are we going to start seeing ghosts movies with CGI ghosts in them of people from that are long gone?
Yeah, you get another 10 or 20 years under your belt with these, and you really, all you'll need is a good voice actor. And even then, you know, maybe in 20 years, they won't even need a good voice actor. They'll be able to have
somebody's old voice. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's an interesting question too, because I remember reading something at one point where, so when you go back so many years ago, and the actor would sign a contract, you know, they didn't sign over their likeness. But like now with these Marvel movies, they sign over their likeness so that toys can be made that look like the actors, mm-hmm. right? So they can't turn around and say, oh, you made that Iron Man action figure look like me, so I'm going to sue you, Marvel, for a share of the profits. So even though they couldn't say Robert Downey Jr., if they wanted to use a CGI version of him in a movie, could they say it's Iron Man and it just happens to look like Robert Downey Jr.?
That's true. That's definitely a weird ethical shifty place to stand. I like that would be fascinating because then you could technically never have to pay anybody.
This is why lawyers are never going out of business.
Right. I mean, how much money did they, you know, dump on Downey this last time? I mean, he made like $75 million on one of these movies, the last big ones that was he was in. Mm-hmm. And so when you think about the contract that this guy has negotiated, does he even care what they do with his CGI face at this point? You know, I mean, how much of 75 million do you need 75 more million? You know, most of us make 30 grand a year tops. And so you got this guy that's like making, you know, what you make in a year in a second of his day. And, you know, I could almost give a shit, excuse my mouth, if somebody used CGI Steve, if I was getting paid that much money, go for it. You could have me doing whatever you wanted in a CGI form, and I would not care.
Be careful what you wish for.
Now stuff's going to start popping up on the internet. Just you wait.
You and Lawrence Fishburne in a warm embrace.
There you go. Well, kind of handsome. I'm down. It's Bank Rush Monday.
So what else was in this?
So the plot, a little bit we'll talk about the plot here. Like, we knew it was coming. They set it up at the end of the first Ant-Man. Like, he went into the Quantum Realm and came out, so it gave Hank hope that he could go in and retrieve Janet out of the Quantum Realm. And, of course, that's the basic plot of the movie. They're figuring out how to go into the Quantum Realm to bring Janet home. And craziness ensues. I mean, like Steve said, it's a simple plot, but you know, that's also kind of refreshing. Like,
you know, it was a rescue mission.
Yes. Complications.
It was just a rescue mission movie with a lot of really interesting pivots into complication. That, to me, the best stories are the ones that are simplified, that don't need a lot of mechanics. There was not a need for this, like, calculus of storytelling. It was just this linear story where you were constantly zigging where you were supposed to zag, and it worked. And they made it fun on top of that, which I think, in a way, that kind of pyrotechnic, that humor pyrotechnic, is a good distraction from the simplicity of the whole narrative.
Right. I can't remember who it was that was on the show recently that said this, and it's so true. Like, if you're going to have a complicated world, and let's face it, trying to get people to buy into the quantum realm and how that works and things being tied to it and people being torn apart, then you need a simple story. Whereas if you have a complicated story, then you want a simple world around it. Right. And yeah, and it works. It really does. I can't argue with that. How about you, John? You have any issues with the plot? Was it straightforward for you?
Yeah, it was pretty straightforward, and it served its purpose, right? And it did change halfway through, because again, you had this sympathetic antagonist that, you know, she was going to die if she didn't get quantumly locked or whatever, and I just mixed like three different franchises.
You really can just put quantum in front of everything.
Quantum entanglement. She needed to become unentangled.
Yeah.
But
it was cool. You know, the science fiction wasn't a leap. It was everything about this movie just had this nice kind of easy going. It wasn't Infinity War is a emotional investment. Like, that is 3 hours of serious stuff going on. This was 2 hours of release. And I think it was a necessary thing, especially with that great credit scene and it ties everything together and puts a bow on it for the next movie. And it kind of lets you know where they're going. Scott Lang is going somewhere that's going to involve this red hair. I don't want to spoil everything in this podcast, but there's this wonderful one line of dialogue right before he enters the bridge at the very end that lets you know what their next plot beat's going to be.
you're welcome to spoil. We warned people.
Okay, well, I mean, the whole time travel dynamic that's going to be introduced for Scott to be able to save Ant-Man's going to save the day.
Yeah.
If, or at least get the ball rolling. I mean, Doctor Strange took the gamble in Infinity War. He, mm-hmm. which I think is a, the more I think about the idea that Stephen Strange knows the outcome has to be the one thing that they didn't want to do is terrible. As a creative person, that's a terrible, terrible, terrible plot beat. Is that, oh, of course, I looked at 14,581 possible probabilities, and there's only one where we win. Of course, it's the one where everybody dies because everybody has to struggle. It was too telegraphed. It makes Stephen Strange look more obnoxious. If this is the case, it's going to make him look like a huge douchebag. We had to go through all this stuff
If he was that when he was fading, he wouldn't have said, it's the only way. He would have said, bye, suckers.
Peace out. I'm out. You know, it would have been Rick Sanchez instead of Dr. Stephen Strange.
Yeah.
Lubba-lubba-dub-dub, bitches. Yeah, I don't know, man. I really like at the very end when he gets left when he gets shrunken down and he's left hanging, I was like, oh, so this is where they're going with this. He's gonna absorb all this healing energy and use it to transverse time and to get out. I think he's gonna wind up, like, they've already shown stills, he's gonna wind up in the setting of the first Avengers movie, and they're gonna alter the structure of time in their own cinematic universe, which again is pretty brilliant because they're literally introducing the general public to the retcon in a way. We hate it as comic book readers. We hate when things get retconned because it's changing. We don't want anything drastic to change about things we like. But they're doing it in a way where they're like, look, this is the retcon, and we have to have it so that our people can live.
If they're going to retcon, the one thing I want to see is when Captain America and Thor and Iron Man were fighting and Loki was up on that hill looking down. I want to see them just stop fighting, look up and say, oh, yeah, he's up to something. There's no way we're taking him to home base.
Right, right. That makes sense. That would be, you know, just a reduction in logic, you know, where you just kind of – the story logic is then reduced into this moment where you see that you anticipate a bad move. It's almost too much of a retcon, but I think it'd be smart too. It would be a good wink at that movie. But, you know.
So before we get too deep into where we think things are going, because I have a couple of thoughts on that as well. Did you guys have any issues with this movie? Anything that you didn't like? I have one, and I let my suspension of disbelief throw it out the window because the movie was fun. But, you know, they spend a lot of time explaining in the first one that even though you shrink down, you're really just... You're keeping the mass, so that's why when he punches someone as a little Ant-Man, it's a full-on force punch because it's all of his actual mass being in one little area that's hitting them.
I know where this is going.
So when you shrink down a building, you're not going to be able to roll it around like a suitcase. But I let that go.
Oh, I didn't think about that.
Yeah. They
once.
They play that really fast and loose. And then there's, you know, also the fact that if you shrink down a building, the structural supports aren't going to really handle it being thrown around or even picked up for that matter. Because, yeah. I mean, it would basically look on a scale, it would look like Godzilla banging, you know, leaning on the building, which, of course, what does? It would crumble and fall.
Right. But they're just picking it up. There's a segment called This Is How Nerds Ruin Everything.
Yes, I know. But no, Dave's right. I mean, but then again, in the original, in the first Ant-Man, they had the same issue where, yeah, it's supposed to work that way, but when it's convenient to the plot, it doesn't.
Right. Like, you couldn't pick up a car. You couldn't pick up a Hot Wheel and put it in the Hot Wheel box. They would all be the mass of a car.
Yeah. And then,
a lot of that, man. This is just. kind of showed me that there's no Santa Claus.
It's ruined. That's it.
The pseudo-scientific dynamic of this movie has now been just turned over for me. I can't. You just lost a second sale.
No, sorry. And then the only other like tiny little issue I have, and it's not, I mean, this one is such a throwaway issue. It's not even important. But it kind of bugged me that the new suit had the helmet flipped on like Iron Man's helmet does now. Appears from the back and flips over his head. You know, well, they did the same thing.
That's ease of use.
That's definitely trademark infringement.
But they did that with, they did that now with the, what's his face? Spider-Man and his Iron Spider suit in Infinity War, and now Ant-Man suit's doing it. And it's just like, can't they all, can't you think of something different for each character?
Does it's everyone just an easy cheat. It's an easy cheat that they can put in and out really quickly. It doesn't require all this time and movement of, let me put on my helmet, you know, let me put on my mask. Oh, I'm adjusting, which would require them cutting away because those masks never truly fit the way they're supposed to. They defy physics. You know, the helmet, I don't know, man. I guess I really don't think about these things in the midst of it. But
and that's the point, though. They do it because they don't want to break the action.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what this does. It avoids breaking the action.
But I didn't feel that it broke the action in the first one. You know, it just, I don't know. It's just a personal
problem. It kind of gave him another conflict. When he was in handcuffs in the first one, he had to wiggle around to get the helmet on because you have to have the helmet on for the costume to work, for the gas to work, and because it's all closed system. That's interesting. I didn't really think about that. And I liked how there was a backup suit, and it was, and the new suit was, I liked the faulty suit thing. That was a good thing for him.
Yeah.
Because it made it unreliable. Because he was, it was, you know, there's this perfect storm. And to be honest, the Wasp is just a scene-stealing monster throughout this entire movie.
Like, oh,
watching her just beat the crap out of everybody she's getting her hands on was hot. But, like, no, but it was awesome. Like I really liked the scene with the car chase where she is just shrinking and growing and shrinking and, like, flipping through windows and stuff. The sequence was just so fast-paced. It was breakneck. And I was just, like, marveling at how well this stuff transitioned, because we all know that most CGI is crappy in movies. It's like second rate because it's done so quickly. But it was so clean looking. The shrinking and growing, shrinking and growing. It was,
oh yeah,
this movie was so clean looking in terms of,
they've got it down to a pseudoscience, really.
Yes, absolutely.
No, I definitely agree with that. Yeah, I mean, but did you guys, they're my two little minor issues with the movie. How about you guys? Anything stand out that, like, bothered you, or?
I needed the issue with the ghost. I needed Foster to be more substantial in his role. He ended up becoming this, like, regrettable ally to the ghost. It's like, I can't stand for this. You're going to do this, but then I can't stand for that. And I'm like, but you just stood for all this other crap, dude. It doesn't, that the logic of Bill Foster in his turn as a character was the only thing that I was disappointed with, because I kind of studied the way, you know, people's narrative arcs and stuff when I'm watching a movie. And that was the only thing, because I really wanted more adversity from Bill Foster. I wanted him to kind of be more of an outlier.
Okay, I agree. I kind of feel that he was, they were trying to portray him as a father figure to Ghost, but like only when it was convenient,
right?
You know, for the story, and that did bother me a little bit as well. Now that you bring it up, yeah. I see you ruined a second viewing for me.
Ruined everything. Volume 2.
I don't see that. And there wasn't very much. I don't think there was anything that really bothered me in this. I mean, even when they went into the scientific babble thing, which all science fiction / hero movies can do. You know, you had Paul Rudd, who would basically all but look at the camera and deadpan. That's what I was thinking. And, you know, and it was all good after that. So, you know, really, the only nitpick I have was those, I guess, three times when they tried to play one of those long running jokes that just go on and on, where they try to make it funny, then let it go to not funny, and then let it go back to funny again, and it didn't work. But otherwise, I don't know. It's the whole movie felt like it was just winking at me. So it's just, sure, let's just have fun with this. I mean, that's what this movie is, you know. It's not trying to tug your heartstrings. It's not trying to rip your heart. It's not trying to make you scream in your seat. It's just like, hey, here's an adventure. Let's go.
No, you're absolutely right. That's a great way of looking at it. It's just one big long elbow to the ribs.
Yeah.
Like, eh? Isn't that funny?
look what he did now. Isn't that cool? That is cool, isn't it?
I don't have a problem with it because of the emotional investment I had with Infinity. I was, like, so happy that it was this fun movie.
Yeah.
Like, I'm excited about Captain Marvel. Like, what they've done is they've done a real good job of using the audience's emotions on the roller coaster, and now we're getting ready to go back up again. Yeah. And it's like you get to go down the ramp a little bit and enjoy your plunge. They've done a super good job. This phase so far has been fantastic.
So, all right. So that brings us to, of course, we don't need to, stupid neighbors go fireworks going off. Anyway, now they're legal in Pennsylvania. It's fun. So of course they retrieve Janet from the quantum realm, and her healing touch fixes Ghost. Like, yeah. Yay, everyone!
That was the Deus Ex Machina of the movie.
Yeah, that. Since it was at the end of the movie, you kind of gloss over it real quick, yeah. And you don't think about it too much. But apparently, Janet has powers from being in the quantum realm for so long. She's absorbed all this quantum energy.
She evolved.
Right.
Was basically what she said.
So obviously, that's going to play out, I think, in a future movie that they haven't gotten to yet. But the real end of the movie is the after credit scene where they need to go back into the quantum realm again. Scott goes in to collect healing quantum energy. They really do just put quantum in front of everything. And while he's in there, he's talking to Hank, Pym, Janet, and Hope. And all of a sudden they stop communicating back because the camera flips back to them, there's turned to dust.
Ash. Yeah.
Yeah.
All three of them, though. That's the thing that bothered me. That was the other thing that stuck out. Why would all three of them have to vanish? Other than it makes no sense for them to develop the story forward, because then he could be pulled out of the quantum realm. So it's like you're this forced idea that 50%, you know, three and a half, like three people are there. So one and a half people aren't going to disappear, but all three of them disappear. You know, that's another thing that I noticed in Infinity War, is that the scene on the planet on Titan, most of those people disappear except for like Doctor Strange and Iron Man.
Right.
Like, yeah. Almost everybody disappears.
I look at it as the law of averages. What is the absolute worst thing that could happen to him? As soon as they said, oh, you're going to go into the quantum realm and get this, I'm like, oh crap, he's getting stranded. They're all gone. That's it.
Well, I mean, it's interesting because definitely that it feels like that scene was added for the tie-in purpose. Like,
it wasn't a pool of water. I mean, you know.
Right. But before you get to that scene, this movie really could stand on its own as a sequel to the first Ant-Man. And yes. That's the scene that truly ties it into what's happening in Infinity War. And obviously something is going to happen between now and either the beginning of Infinity War or in Captain Marvel that gets Scott out of the quantum realm. So this is the part of the podcast where we're going to speculate a little bit on.
It'll be Louise. Louise is going to happen by and get him out. That's you know, it'll be really quick.
Well, I mean,
I think we're going to see some interference from somebody else from the Marvel Universe. I think that I think Stephen Strange is going to show up. Somebody random that is able to influence time in a way.
You mean Adam Warlock?
I don't know, man. I don't know. Have they said anything definitive about Warlock showing up in the next movie?
Yes.
No.
Do we know who's cast as Adam Warlock, or is it going to be a CGI person with a man voice? Bar none, Adam Warlock is like one of my top five favorite characters in the Marvel Universe. It's like my bucket list, probably my number two bucket list thing to write for Marvel, if I could ever attain that goal. So I'm very much anticipating the arrival of this character and the way that they bring this character in. It's going to be really hard to pull off because that is such a unique character to the Marvel Universe that most of the time that he's represented in comics, they don't ever do him justice. He became a background note in the Lanning Abnett Guardians of the Galaxy. And I'm like, dude, this is a guy that's like beaten Thanos, wielded the Infinity Gauntlet. You know, he's Warlock in the Infinity Watch was a cool book. I probably was one of the only four people who read it, but it was a cool book.
From my understanding, they're saving him for Guardians Volume 3.
Oh, okay. Well, is Guardians Volume 3 coming out next year?
No.
I don't know. I don't pay attention.
As far as I know, no, that's not next year. They don't have a definitive release date for that one yet.
But I'm looking at the casting for the next Avengers movie, and it's Evangeline Lilly's in it. So I guess she comes back.
I'm going to that movie on that premise alone.
Yeah. Well, that was easy.
I'm easy.
Well, I'm going for Mark Ruffalo, so.
That's good, too.
So, apparently, there are rumors floating around, and one of the rumors is that Avengers 4 starts off 5 years in the future after what happened in Infinity War, and that's led some to speculate that maybe Scott spends 5 years trapped in the quantum realm.
That would ruin his character.
Well, that also explains why they cast somebody older to be Cassie.
Right. And that, so then he absorbs the quantum energy and he has whatever, you know, powers that the Janet had, but at a lesser extent. So
I don't know. That could be, I mean, there's a lot of cool stuff that as a creative guy, I'm still trying to figure out how they can bring Wonder Man into the picture because he's another one of my favorite characters. So it's like anytime there's any ionic energy or interdimensional energy, I'm like, could somebody become Wonder Man from this? Because who's okay? What's his face is playing Wonder Man, Simon Williams, in all the movies. He's already been cast. The dude from everybody always gets upset because I don't love this guy like everybody else because I didn't watch Firefly. Yeah, big reveal. You didn't watch Firefly. I was living at the time. It was like when I was in college. Hashtag college. What is that guy's name?
Everybody
loves this guy.
You're talking Nathan Fillion.
Yes.
Nathan Fillion?
He's been cast as Simon Williams.
Right.
So we could have jumpsuit, red jacket, Wonder Man played by somebody who's perfect for the role if they just figure out a way to make me happy.
Apparently they filmed something for Guardians Volume 2, which got cut with him what's Wonder Man's alter ego? Simon Williams. Play him being an actor in a movie.
Right. I remember reading about that. And then I think that he has a, I could have swore I read something where he might show up in Captain Marvel as a movie star also. So I hope so, because that would just be another one of these cool characters that is CGI'd into the Marvel Universe, and then you could have this fan favorite dude voice the CGI body if you do ionically charged, you know, Wonder Man. Because you could also have Eric Johnston's come in as a villainous Goliath because he's ionically charged. There is a lot of cool stuff you could do with another Ant-Man movie where you could have these I don't want to call them C-list villains, but they're C-list villains that could be, you know, made into something cool. And right. I still think it would be great if Michael Peña became Giant Man. So, because I think he's like, I didn't realize how much of a hilarious element he brings to these movies until I think back of the first Ant-Man, and then I watch the new one, and he's doing that storytelling thing that he does, where and like they have all the people mimicking his voice or mouthing the words he's saying. That's a really funny, unique thing to those movies. So, and I hope they keep doing it.
So,
and what you know, I gotta wonder, Nathan, how they cast Nathan Fillion into this, because he was dating Michelle Hoover, who played the woman. She played the woman that Stan Lee was hitting on in the first Guardians of the Galaxy movie, and she was also in the background as like the personal assistant for the head of that world. I forget what her name was.
Well, Fillion was CGI'd in as one of the goons in the prison in the first Guardians of the Galaxy. He was the big purple dude that they fought in the jail, space jail.
Oh, perfect.
As far as I remember reading, like he was, he played a small part.
The funny thing is, this the Marvel universe is so big now that you can play 7 Degrees and everybody and play it all with Marvel movies.
Yeah, you can. I mean, think about how many movies have they put out? They've put out successfully. How many of, okay, let's think about this. They've put out a slew of movies and only like one or two of them are not great. If like they're not fun to the point where it's like the first Thor is not a good movie. The second Thor is okay. The third Thor is bonkers good. Like they made a Flash Gordon Thor movie.
I think the second Thor movie was better, was the worst of the first two.
I agree with you. I didn't think the first Thor was great, but I remember dozing off in the second Thor.
Hmm.
And I was just kind of like, man, if I'm dozing off in a Marvel movie, it's not a good movie. Because normally I'm ready to like turn a cartwheel and I'm bottom heavy so I could break my neck. But like, it's just, I just didn't care about any of that plot. It was a disposable plot to make a sequel movie, you know, an obligatory, you know, chain movie. The first Captain America movie, as much as I love Captain America, that first movie was pretty wooden. But of course, they came back with Winter Soldier, which was like the French Connection of superhero movies. And it was just like a super good intrigue movie. And, right. You know, Civil War and Winter Soldier are so good that when your flagship movies aren't as good as those two Captain America sequels, it's tough, man. Cause I was like, man, it's hard. It's tough in the streets. Cause those I will go down swinging that those are the best two Marvel movies.
So Ant-Man and the Wasp is the 19th MCU movie.
That's incredible. And how many movies has Warner made? Four. I just don't even think about Suicide Squad because it was such a throwaway movie. It was such a throwaway movie. And I really, and this sounds terrible, I hate Will Smith. I don't like anything that Will Smith is in. And like the last movie I liked with him was The Legend of Bagger Vance. And I just, he sucks all the light out of the room, kind of like Tom Cruise does. If Tom Cruise shows up as Tony Stark, I'm done. I'm out. I'm like, peace out. Deuces. I'm done. I'm just going to start watching reruns of The Office.
Okay. With that, we should rate this movie before we go on to a full rant.
So, well real quick. Okay, real quick. Though you had mentioned, Steve, you mentioned earlier the wonderful concept of retcon. So if Avengers 4 involves time travel, which it does seem like it involves some kind of time travel, and there are people arguing, well, how can you do time travel without screwing up timeline? We got a taste of that in from Days of Future Past in the X-Men franchise. However, that being said, do you guys think they could use that as an opportunity to either A, introduce the Fantastic Four without having to like totally redo their origin story again, and B, possibly replace a key actor or two.
Okay. I have already thought about this as a creative person because I want the Fantastic Four to happen. If I were to do anything, it would be to make the event from the first Avengers movie the catalyst for what creates the Fantastic Four in outer space. Like maybe they were sent up to monitor the opening in the sky. Mm-hmm. And then when it explodes, after Tony blows it up, it releases cosmic radiation on their ship, and they're in the background of the Marvel Universe the whole time. Just because not on the screen doesn't mean they don't already exist. That's the wonderful thing that we can do with these movies, is you can kind of break up your timeline and have this nonlinear narrative. I mean, we've been doing this in comics for decades. Why not? And we don't have to do it and explain it. We just go, hey, this took place during this. And people go, oh, okay. Because they already watch soap operas. They know how this stuff works. You know, right. The audience isn't dumb. And they're smart enough to play along. And I think that that's fantastic. So that's this creative guy would have it so that they've been existing the whole time. They're just doing other things in the Marvel Universe. It's a big universe.
Right.
Yeah. I want John Krasinski to be Mr. Fantastic.
I just bring that up because, of course, the news is that the Federal Trade Commission has approved the merger. So it's going to happen.
It's just a matter of time before the Monopoly guy shows up.
He's already there. He's wearing mouse ears.
I know.
Cool. All right. So as John said, this is probably a good point to do our final thoughts and give a rating. So Steve, since you're the guest, you can go first. And of course, we normally give it a rating of 1 to 10 capes is what we normally use here on the show. And, so yeah, what's your final thoughts and your final rating on this movie?
Every once in a while, you need some big dumb fun. I think that every once in a while, when you have all these movies that are serious and they carry all this gravitas and they're trying to carry these heavy messages and continuous messages, it's nice to have a little aside where there's some dancing monkeys and, you know, an organ grinder. And this is that moment. And I think that it was such, like I said earlier, there were so many little small pieces that carried this thing from moment to moment that it made one big orchestrated, unique story. And it was just so much fun, and it was lighthearted. The other thing I noticed, you could take your kids to that, not be worried about it. There were maybe two cuss words in that entire movie, maybe three. And I was kind of marveling at the fact that you could take an 8-year-old to this and be comfortable and not have to, like, wince, do that adult wince. And so I give this movie, like, 8.5 capes.
Oh, wow. Great rating. Cool. John?
It's just good, clean fun. Don't go see it for an epic adventure. Go see it for just a fun romp with a lot of really good the action scenes in this were amazing. They really were very well done. There's not much more I can really say about it. I'll give it like, I'm going to give it 8.5 bullet ants.
Cool. I definitely echo your guys' sentiments. It's funny, Kevin Feige was asked at one point, you know, now that phase 3 is, you know, coming to an end, what are your plans for phase 4? And he said, I don't know if we're really going to worry about phases so much anymore as just getting back to telling good standalone movies and not worrying as much about how they tie into this great big epic. And this is a great example of them possibly going down that road again. I mean, it's a great movie. It's funny. I think Paul Rudd was meant to play Scott Lang. You know, he's the right amount of charming and funny for the movie. And, I really enjoyed it. And I'm going to echo your guys' score. I'm going to say 8.5 flying ants. And, yeah. So the consensus here, boys and girls, is run out and see the movie if you haven't yet. If you haven't and you've listened this far, you've been spoiled.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, and cool. So, Steve, before we wrap it up, anything? Where can people find you online?
Well, you can find me on Twitter. It's like steve.ekstrom, E-K-S-T-R-O-M. Have fun with that. Call me whatever you want. I'm on Facebook. You can go to the Eminent Press Facebook page, the Terminal Pulp Anthology Facebook page. All of us are linked to it. Find me on – I'm on every platform. I am a absolute hoe for social media. So I get out there and I turn tricks. So that's what you got to do to make it big, right? So I'm out there. Look me up. Feel free to add me. I will add you back 99% of the time. And I like to talk to everybody and engage them. So, and we've got our Kickstarter coming up, and that's HTTP, imminent, our Kickstarter page. If you want to check out the first Kickstarter, it'll be the same address for the second Kickstarter.
Cool. And I'll include those links again down below. And we're going to have you guys back on definitely when you're ready to start the next Kickstarter. So
sweet. We'll talk to you next month then.
Cool.
All right, boys and girls, on that note, as always, thanks for listening, and don't let your cape get caught in the door. Have a good evening.